This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Racial Justice Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The U.S. economic system is facing increasing scrutiny for the wealth inequality it has generated, and that continues to worsen. A significant part of the stranglehold that our current form of capitalism has is simply cultural. The idea that when stock prices are booming and the Dow Jones is high, the economy is healthy, and therefore ordinary Americans are thriving. But applying a clarifying lens to the prevailing economic model reveals that we live under a system of what my guest calls wealth supremacy. Marjorie Kelly is a distinguished fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. She's a leading theorist in democratic economy design, and she joins me to discuss her latest book, Wealth Supremacy, How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. Welcome to the program, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali. I'm glad to be here.
So first, how do we define wealth supremacy? You know, I'm the racial justice editor at Yes Magazine, and so I talk often about white supremacy. Right. What is wealth supremacy? Is there an analogy, and is there even overlap with white supremacy?
Yes, there's definitely an analogy and an overlap, and it was deliberate when I chose this title, because I'm trying to show how similar they are. So wealth supremacy is the idea that wealthy people matter more than the rest of us. They deserve more power, they deserve more comfort, more prosperity, and that's normal, and that's the way things should be. It's very similar to white supremacy. It's kind of the norms of society that can fall to the background and can seem acceptable until you point out that this is really bias. And that it's not legitimate. So that's what I'm trying to do here, is to say this really is a biased system. If you suspect that it's rigged against you, it is, and I show how. Yes, and the two do overlap a lot. I think people of color understand instinctively and intuitively that property ownership is a concept that is can be weaponized and can be used against people. And that's a lot what's happening in the system of wealth supremacy.
Is it just cultural, or is it also built into the system? Well, let's talk about the systemic nature in which how our economic system is designed to privilege the wealthy. You know, I think many of us do know that even white people understand from a very instinctive level that the wealthier you are, the more loopholes you have, the more benefits you get through our tax system, through our, you know, through the economic models that the government has adopted, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly right. Look at the 2008 meltdown, for example. Predatory mortgages from the big banks, and there was a big institutional investors and wealthy investors who supported this, you know, came in and basically took the equity out of people's homes through predatory mortgages. It was mostly or often people of color who lost their homes, who were pushed into predatory mortgages when they could have qualified for regular mortgages. So that there we see racial inequity happening, but it's happening hand in hand with what I call capital bias or wealth supremacy. So, you know, these big banks, these big institutional investors, you know, if they can make money on racism, they will, but they aren't necessarily even aware of the racism involved. They just want the maximum returns. So yes, the two are entirely entwined.
So the economy is rigged. If you're wealthy, the more wealth you have, the more wealth you can make. Billionaires know right. This. Even those very, very few billionaires who try to give away their wealth end up accruing wealth faster than they can give it away, just because of the way the system is set up. And that's quite remarkable, right? And I'm wondering if you can also explain how our system has become perverted away from the sort of real nuts and bolts idea of what we think of as wealth. A home to most of us is wealth, but that's not how our system really defines it, right?
Yeah, so let's talk for a second, Sonali, about how the system is rigged. So what I do in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is I look at seven myths, which really form the operating system of capitalism. And the first one is no amount of wealth is ever enough. That is the prime, it's the primary principle built into investing. You know, Bill Gates, at one point, the founder of Microsoft, at one point, he had $10 billion. That's You could fund 100 dynasties that would last for generations with that. But what did he do? He invested, and 2 decades later, he had $300 billion. And so, no amount of wealth is ever enough. You keep investing, you keep wanting more. That's one myth. Another is that workers are not members of the corporation, and this is how corporate governance is designed. It's only capital that has a vote inside the corporation. The board of directors is elected by capital, and the more wealth you have, the more votes you have. So right there, you see how capital is empowered. Whereas if labor wants to be empowered, they have to go out and organize shop by shop by shop. And a place like Starbucks will have 1,800 shops, and so you have to organize 1,800 shops. Whereas capitalism is empowered automatically without a single fight required. So those are a couple of examples of how the myths that the system operates by and how it's rigged. And so you said. How has it gotten so out of whack? Well, I grew up in a family. My father ran a small business. My grandfather had a slightly larger business. We were never wealthy, but we had enough money. We lived on one salary. I was able to go to college without a lot of debt. And my mother was able to retire without having to work outside the home. There was no dynasty. There was no, huge transfer of intergenerational wealth, but there was some cushion and some prosperity. That is not how, that's how the system used to work, how it's supposed to work, and it doesn't anymore. I mean, even the middle class doesn't have assets. You have 2 out of 3 Americans lack even $1,000 to fall back on. I mean, Sonali, you and I could think of a million ways that you need $1,000. Your car breaks down, you have a kid who needs a band uniform, maybe you want to take a little vacation or something. I mean, $1,000 is nothing. And yet people don't, 2 out of 3 don't even have that. Meanwhile, not only has the number of billionaires grown, which we hear about that a lot, but one of the things I look at in the book is how aggregate financial wealth has grown. So if you take all financial assets, stocks and bonds and debts of various kind, and you think of that as a sphere, so that used to be equal to GDP, which is gross domestic product, and that's like income and spending. So that's the real economy. People, work jobs, they get money, they spend their money. That's the GDP. But meanwhile, there's this sphere of financial assets, which is now 5 times GDP, and it grows by extraction. It keeps it wanting to extract more and more and get bigger and bigger and bigger, because as we said, no amount of wealth is ever enough. And so in the aggregate, what we have now is a financialized capitalism. It's a new kind of capitalism. It's not about robber barons. It's not even about CEOs. It's about capital, and capital is on autopilot and trying to grow and get bigger. And it's become a destructive force, capturing government. Dark money is funding some of this hard right insanity that's happening. You have, ExxonMobil won't stop producing fossil fuels because it feels it has an obligation to its shareholders. And so on. So there are all kinds of forms of real devastation that are happening. Families loaded with debt, workers who their jobs have been turned into contingent, part-time, insecure jobs. 40% of jobs are now insecure and contingent in that way. And so all of this devastation is happening while these wealthy portfolios expand and expand and expand. And it's reached a point of of real trouble and absurdity.
I want to get to the designing alternative models part of it and what you mean by a democratic economy. But just picking up on what you were talking about, this idea of fiduciary responsibility, and it's something that you write about. Tell me more about that. It's not something that we think about unless we're economists, we think about. But the fact that it is such a sort of considered a sacrosanct thing in our economy is a huge reason why we have a climate crisis and so much poverty and inequality, right?
It's really true. I thank you for pointing that one out. That's another of the myths that I point to. And a fiduciary duty, boy, you know, it sounds so benign. It sounds so technical. You know, you just want to, you know, yawn. It's so boring. And fiduciary duty, what it means is, let's say that you or I has a little bit of assets, and so we turn it over to a mutual fund or an investment advisor. Well, that fund or advisor has an obligation to act in our behalf, right? That manager can't run off and invest the money in their crazy Uncle Harry, or they can't take the money and spend it on their own vacation in the Bahamas. You know, they have a fiduciary duty to take care of their client and act like it's their client's money and not their own. Well, that's fine and that's necessary and that's good. We all want that. It's pretty necessary and benign. But there's this other thing that's tucked inside fiduciary duty, and it's what I call capital bias. And it's this idea that only capital matters, which is another word for wealth, and nothing else matters. So if you're going out and trying to return good returns to your investor, if you trash the environment, if you devastate society, if you ruin the lives of tens of thousands of laborers, doesn't matter. It's not material. The only thing that matters is maximizing those gains for capital. So that capital bias that's tucked into fiduciary duty, that's the danger. And we don't see it because we're taught, oh, well, of course you have to, you know, be responsible in how you manage investments. Well, of course you do, but you don't have to pretend that nothing else in the world matters. And that's the problem.
So we have a constitution that determines and tells us that all people are created equal, and yet we have an economic system that says, no, if you're wealthy, then you matter more. How do we redesign our economic system to actually adhere to the tenets of a liberal democracy?
Yeah, so a society half democratic and half plutocratic is not going to endure. And that's what we have right now. So one side or the other is going to take over, right? Either we're going to have plutocrats taking over the government, hamstringing politicians with, you know, political donations and lobbying by corporations. We're going to stop our ability to deal with climate change because ExxonMobil won't like it. So you can have plutocracy take over, and that's what happens in financialization. Or you can have democracy be suffused throughout society. So we have a democratic government and we have a democratic economy. That's what we're working for, the democracy collaborative. And I have been tracking this as a journalist and a theorist and a consultant for really three decades now, Sonali. And I've written for Yes Magazine. Yes Magazine is one of the wonderful outlets that is promoting a democratic economy and various models. So what does it mean? So we have an extractive economy, which we have now, or you have a democratic economy, right? So an extractive economy is designed to extract maximum wealth for the few. It's about extracting financial wealth. Well, a democratic economy is designed to serve all of us, to help us all prosper and have lives of dignity and freedom, and to have a living earth, a sustainable earth, because of course you can't have lives of dignity and meaning when ecological devastation is all around us. So how do you design that? First of all, it's about what do we care about? Social institutions are really designed around our values, right? Democracy is about, you know, liberty and equality and justice. Well, a democratic economy is about those things. It's also about fairness. It's about sustainability. It's about community. And people instinctively care about these values. These are things that we care about. And so how do you design for community? Well, for example, the community should own its own water. It should own electricity. And there are 85% of Americans who right now, we get our water from municipally owned utilities, city owned, county owned. This is government ownership, right? We're taught to fear government ownership as though it's communism, but that's absurd. That's just red baiting. You want public ownership of essential assets like water. Meanwhile, big capital is out there trying to buy water rights in Colorado and California. I open my book, Wealth Supremacy, with that very scary story. We're coming into a world of water shortages. And so who's going to be in control of water? Is it going to be big capital trying to make a ton of money on it? Or is it going to be communities who see water as a human right? And that we all need to have access to water every single day. Every living creature does, not just humans. And so this is one of the big battlegrounds ahead is water. Electricity. There are municipally owned and cooperatively owned electricity in our country. And it's shown that there are lower rates and better service when it's owned cooperatively or by the community. 15% of forests worldwide are now controlled by indigenous communities or by community groups. And the UN has said that this model is vital to preserving ecological biodiversity. So you can have worker ownership of firms. There's 6,000 substantially worker-owned firms, including Recology in the Bay Area, which is a $1 billion company. And it's 100% owned by its workers. It serves communities up and down the West Coast. It has a mission of a world without waste. And it pays garbage truck drivers $100,000 a year, because if you're not extracting a lot of wealth for shareholders, there's more to go around for workers. Worker ownership. So you can also have community land trusts, which keep housing affordable. So there's state-owned banks, community-rooted banks. So there's a variety of models. They have the public good at their core, and they have broad-based ownership, either workers, or you have farmer-owned cooperatives, a community-owned solar and water, and so on. So you want broad-based ownership, the public good at the core, and we need a great ownership transition. That's one great process that we need toward a democratic economy. And another is we need new forms of capital as well.
So it's not as though there's some never before thought of idea on how to make our economy more democratic. There's models that already exist, and it's a matter of changing the priorities and the systemic built-in biases of our economy. So to that end, how do we change our culture to help Americans, be on board with this? First of all, reject the current system and then be on board with redesigning the system. That it feels like we need a class consciousness that the U.S. unfortunately doesn't have, because we tend to all be aspirational billionaires, right? Or many of us think that we're just billionaires in waiting.
Yeah, you're right. I love what you said, that these models exist. They've been proven. It's not as though, I'm talking about some pie in the sky thing. And so we need a change of consciousness. One of the things I talk about in my book, Wealth Supremacy, is where do we start? How can we participate in this system change, really, is what we're talking about. And I say that the first thing we need to do is to talk to each other, right? We need to read my book, read other books, read about these various models and get a little bit educated. Talk to each other so that we give each other permission to think this way. The mainstream media isn't as much help as it should be. I mean, of course, you hope that this concept of wealth supremacy will catch on and people will, that language maybe will help, or the democratic economy, that concept can help. But, you know, I think back, Sonali, to the 70s and second wave feminism. And where do you start? And, you know, women were in at their kitchen tables talking to each other, you know, about their unease and about something didn't seem right, and recognizing that sexism was real, you know, that male supremacy was real. You know, people of color have helped us as a culture to understand that white supremacy is real. And so we need a similar kind of, you know, almost like a kitchen table movement to say wealth supremacy is real. This is not hand waving. This is not ideological arguing. It's a real force in our society, and we need to see it. It's a force as big as climate change, and yet much more invisible. And I think once we see it, we'll be motivated to act. That's my hope.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Marjorie. Is there a website that you can share where people can find out more about the work you do?
Sure. Yes. Go to I'm going to mention two. Go to wealthsupremacy.org, and you'll see different things I've written there. Learn about the book. And you can also go to democracycollaborative.org and learn about the organization where I work that's working to build a democratic economy.
Wonderful. We'll post links to both of those from our site. Thank you so much, Marjorie.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Marjorie Kelly, a distinguished senior fellow at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit working to catalyze the creation of a democratic economy. We've been discussing her new book, Wealth Supremacy: How the Extractive Economy and the Biased Rules of Capitalism Drive Today's Crises. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, racial justice editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.